My dear students, it is Monday, August 30th, 2021, and I have to tell you honestly, and with Ella Kaddish Baruch Hu, at my age, I'm able to teach, and yesterday's shiur was a little special, I'll put it. And I spoke in great depth. I realized I went very quickly when I dealt with the sniff and the kuntis hashach. I dealt with it a few years ago in great detail. I only wish my lectures were indexed so I could tell you exactly what to go back to. But I will elaborate another minute on the Meiri and the Rav and the story of Rabbi Volk. It seems those stories hit home. And so from the questions I got that, I have to be a little bit clearer. All right, but be that as it may, let's move into our Monday gestalt, we'll put it that way. And as I said last week, by way of introduction, these classes began back in 1980, and I'm free to do whatever I want outside the world of halacha and response literature, which I deal with on Sunday. And over the years, I've touched upon many topics, but perhaps for the last 10, we've been dealing with the history of Torah in the United States or in the Western world. And all of you know that I began way back in 1886. We walked the streets of New York. We were in the snowstorm. And I was happy to see that everything I remember from my youth and hearing stories from the elderly gentlemen who were my age in 1940s, those stories are correct. Historically, you find them in the memoir literature. When we finished Teira Vedas and Torah Mesorah, Mr. Mendelovich, I was ready to begin Satmar, but I had pangs of conscience that there are three individuals who, today the world doesn't start to understand who they are and what they were, and they had quite a big impact. And these were three people raised following during the Shoah, I should say, and after the Shoah, and the State of Israel, and the Russian situation, and they wanted to change the entire world to see every Jew a Shema Torah mitzvah, at least according to Reb Meir living in Israel, and certainly Reb Shlomo and Esther and Grace were big fans of the State of Israel. They have many descendants living here. To talk about them, you have to understand them in context, and we spent a lot of time on Shlomo. I want to end off today, and there's no question that Ein Lecha Adam Shein Lo Sha'ah. I've often thought about my life, which has not been free of excitement and achievement, and being at least trying to be a good Torah Jew. What is the greatest moment? And I don't have an answer. I can't tell you what is my greatest achievement. I have a lot of Divrei Torah in this. It's not for now. I have from the Rav. It's even not right to look for your greatest achievement, because then the Ribbono Shel Olam can say, you've done your Shlichat Alei Adama, and who call you in? And I don't want to be called in. If you recall, when I turned 80, I turned down all the people who wanted to honor me. You remember what I said, that I have friends who turned 80 and they got covered malachim and awards and dinners, and they don't want to go further. So I turned 80, and I have to say the only ones who surprised me was Yeshiva University, and that I greatly appreciated, because it's good to know that you're not taken for granted and they appreciate what you're doing. Outside of that, I absolutely refused, and even there I would have refused had they asked me, but they surprised me. But be it as it may, you talk about what was Reb Shlomo's greatest moment. And people will say his writing, his songs. There's no question that what he did for Russian Jewry, and it was Kli Achiyat. It's not that he planned this. It's not that he was heavily involved at first. But that visit to Czechoslovakia, And then seeing a communist country when he snuck in, And he was overwhelmed by these Jewish kids who lined up to put on tefillin. And that's when he wrote Am Yisrael Chai, Od Avinu Chai. Jacob Birnbaum gets a lot of credit for knowing who to turn to. Now, I just want to mention in relation to that trip... excuse me?
He did not write Od Avinu Chai yet in Krakow.
I understand. It's afterwards. He first read Am Yisrael Chai and then he added on Od Avinu Chai later. It's all there in the books that I quoted. But what's amazing about the story of his trip to Prague, and here I have to tell you, there's a machleket ha-poskim. If you recall yesterday, I told you, I said that Kloizer Megarebi had 10 children, 11 children, no. And if you heard yesterday, sure, you found out I was right. He actually had 11 children. All were killed by Hitler. However, 10 were killed during the Holocaust. The 11th one died shortly after when the camp was liberated. So it's, people say 10, people say 11. 11 is more correct. With Shlomola, when did he visit Prague? So the doctorate in Shlomo, the Bible, is until now at least, is the volume that I quoted by Nathan Offenbach and Nathan Afir. It's a very scholarly volume. And he comes up with the year 1965. There's only one problem. We have on the website, I thank Yomo for downloading it for me, you have Schleimel in one of his concerts talking about the trip to Prague. And Schleimel says, it was in 1964. So now you wind up in the literature, some say 65, some say 64. I go with the 1965 date. I'll tell you why. That was research, and they know when he was in Berlin, and Ophir knew what he was doing. Schleimele, when you recollect, you think back on life, let me put it this way. I'm very proud of one achievement. My scholarly memoir, From Washington to Washington, it's over 500 pages. No one has found one mistake in it. Now, I've read other memoirs, and I can tell you their mistakes. The truth is, I worked unbelievably hard as if I'm writing history. Anything I wrote about, I checked out to the end. Generally, when you write a memoir, mitrachten in Welterein, you don't, atam lo medaktikim kol kach. Schleimele Karbach spoke about 64, it was really 65. So if anyone asks you, Rakefet said 65, Schleimele says 64, all right, choose your side. But I'll stick to 65, but I was asked, and that's why I want to comment. What's amazing, and again, how much can we believe Schleimele? He's telling his own memoir. So he tells the story. He was in Berlin, and he had a few days free until his next concert in France, and he wanted to do something, and suddenly people in Berlin mentioned, you know, it's not that far to get to Czechoslovakia, to Prague, and he's an enikel of the Maral. And he didn't have a visa. Now you got to know, with the communist countries, you do not play games. I had a visa three times under communism. All right, I was shaking in my pants because I was getting a visa for a person who really didn't exist. The name was Aaron Rakefet. That was correct. They called it Rakfet. All the other information was false, where I live, what I do, who I am, etc. All right, so Schleimele decides to go. He gets on a plane to Prague without a visa. This is the 60s. It was possible then. Today you can't get on a plane. I still remember getting on planes in America where you basically didn't even have to identify yourself. You just showed your ticket. But it's a different world today. He gets on the plane, and people thought he was off the wall. They said to him, but how are you going? You don't have a visa. So he now comes into Prague, and the guy at the customs, the officer there, He tells him, and Shlomo's native language is German, so he speaks to him in German, and he tells him he's coming to visit the grave of his great-grandfather, the Maral of Prague. The customs officer, the KGB agent, call him what you want, goes crazy with joy. This guy says to him, my mother used to tell me stories about him. And he said, you're a great-grandson. He hugs Shlomo, and he gives him a visa for 1 week. Then he comes to Prague. He goes into the nicest hotel. Under communism, what they called nice would be not even a one-star hotel. But all right, it's a hotel. I remember where we were in Russia, what the hotels were like. Yesh the yesh. Even under the communists, there were some fancy hotels to bring in foreign currency. But yesh the yesh. And he comes into the hotel, and this lady is at the desk. And I have to tell you, this someone who visited communist Russia understands this. All of you will understand me, but the depth understanding is someone who was there. And here's a lady at the hotel, at the desk, very efficient, very nice. And she speaks German, and Shlomo speaks German, and he hears Shlomo with a beard, with payas, and she's staring at him. And staring at him. And he sees that she's looking at him, and he decides to hang out in the lobby. Finally, she comes up with enough courage to walk over to him. And all in German, you don't know what it means for me to see you, I'm also Jewish. And to see a Jew with a beard and payas with the traditional look. And he describes, he comes to the synagogue. So the head of the synagogue, of course, is a communist agent, a Jew, like in Moscow. We also were warned who you can talk with, who you can't. And the minute he says he's an Einikel of the Maralmi Prague, the man's heart breaks down. And he says, we never allowed outsiders to do anything in the synagogue, but you can do whatever you want. You can speak, you can daven. And it was a night to remember. And this is Schleimler's memoir that adds a little bit of ice to the details that the volumes of research tell you very coldly. Okay, and I want to go one step further. And you all know we live in a world today where unfortunately there's a chasm, the right wing, the left wing, the centrist. I don't have to elaborate. So I've taken in these lectures, I've dealt with Shlomo, I've dealt with the questions, the problems. I don't want to skip anything. And I came up with a very positive attitude towards him. So you may say, all right, Rakefet is a nice guy, he's a Eurasian Mayan, but he's a YU guy with all that that implies. So I want to show you from the right-wing world, give you a little bit of how one of the great tzaddikim of the right-wing world, this is a memorable man, he died a year or two ago, I think it was his first Yahrzeit recently, and an entire volume just came out about him in an Otzkra volume, Harav David Trenk, T-R-E-N-K. Now, I don't know how many of you know the name. I know the name, even though he became very famous after I'd gone on Aliyah. I'm living in Israel for my 53rd year now. But he was born in 1941. He died in 2019. And it's worth looking at the Art Scroll volume. Here you have someone who grew up in Mir Yeshiva in Brooklyn. Mir Yeshiva in Brooklyn, it's interesting, it never really caught on to the extent that Mir in Yerushalayim caught on. Mir in Yerushalayim may very well be the biggest yeshiva in the world. It's many yeshiva under one roof, I've said that more than once. Lakewood emulates it today. Lakewood also has thousands upon thousands of students, and it's many different yeshivat chaburot under one roof. In America, Mir Yeshiva remained on the map. I would say in the 60s, the 70s, it was perhaps more popular than today. It was easy to go from Mir. You can actually walk to Brooklyn College if you wanted. Today you can go to Brooklyn College, you can go to Truro College, you can take courses at Landa College that are open beyond the students of Landa. But Mir had some of the, I would say, the refugees who remained in America. Again, this story has to be written properly, and many, if one of you wants to do a PhD thesis, it would be fascinating. The Mir came to America in full force, Reb Chaim Shmulevich, Reb Chatzkel Levenstein, and ultimately the heart of the Mir Yeshiva in America, Brooklyn, went to Yerushalayim. They joined Eliezer Yehuda Finkel, Lazy Yehuda Finkel, in Yerushalayim. And it's interesting, and these were people who were wined and dined in America, but they couldn't take the Gashmi yet. They couldn't, these were Balei Musa, this was Chatzkel Levenstein. And they wound up in Israel, they wound up in Mir. Reb Chatzkel later becomes Mashgiach in Panovich. And I mean, his famous, the Shmuis is, when Kennedy was assassinated on Friday, you remember? And the news reached Israel right at Kabbalat Shabbat, 7 hours ahead. Kennedy was assassinated at 1 o'clock. I mean, anyone who lived that period, I can tell you exactly where I was at the moment the news came over. It's the 1 o'clock news, and 1:02, 1:03, they interrupted. The president has been shot. Now, we were in a state of shock, I don't have to tell you. And Reb Chatzkel began his shmuas that Shabbos, Ein zevel mir gesagt, as mit der Hagit, that the Nasi, the president from America, he said, if anyone would have told me they're going to kill the president of America, Kennedy, the world worshipped him, Yo, Camelot, etc., youth, Jacqueline. And he was a Meredith Shmuis, that what can happen in life when you're not a Ben Torah, when you're not ruled by Midah Tovah and Yiret Shemayim, etc. All right, today, and I have to be honest, I mourned Kennedy, I eulogized him. My eulogy was later, they read it on the radio, they asked me for a copy, and then a copy was sent to Jacqueline, and she sent me a thank you note. I wasn't better than any other eulogist, but there must have been 1,000 eulogies among the Rabbanim they sent. Of course, today we find out Kennedy, Clinton, Ribbono Shel Olam, take a look at our political leaders. But we'll leave that for another shmuas. I have plenty to say on that too, but not for now. So Reb David Trenk was an individual who went to Mir, remained in Mir, was very close to the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Shmuel Brudny, Rav Kalmanovich. This was the world he grew up in. And then he went out and organized, ultimately it was in Adelphi, New Jersey. That's where he became most famous. In Adelphi, it was a very unique yeshiva for people in the black world, the Haredi world, the yeshiva world, who couldn't fit in to the regular yeshiva. And he had an ability, Reb David had an ability that he was able to be makariv these people, and no matter what their background, no matter what their problem, generally speaking, he was 100% matzliach. And people speak of him in awe until today, his smile, his handshake, his concern. I would say he was the quintessential Rebbe for in this type of world. Now, afterwards, he, like everyone else, by the way, Adelphi is not that far from Lakewood. I printed out, Yomo printed out a map. From Lakewood to Adelphi, it was a 13-minute bus ride, okay? There were two different buses. One went one way, one was 18 minutes, one 13 minutes. And this was at Delphi, I remember it so well. Then he opened up, it's like a branch, but became also very, very occupied in Lakewood. And this was Reb David Trenk. Now, you go to Baltimore, and I was scholar in residence in Baltimore, and a family that hosted us, we became very close to, the Schlesberg family. Anyone from Baltimore will recognize the name. Eli and Ronnie Schlesberg, in my humble opinion, they are among the leading balabatim in Baltimore. Tremendous chesed, Eli, I saw with my own ears and eyes. He runs at Stucker Fund, and people bother him endlessly. They can't pay the mortgage, they can't pay the electrical bill. Someone goes to jail in Baltimore, it was a famous case, and he leaves a wife with young children with no support. And I'm a shim tzaddikim. But, and the Tomchei Shabbos, as a matter of fact, there was a book that came out of pictures by Geffen, put it out, of communities in America. The photographer is a dentist, but his avocation is photography, and beautiful pictures. One of the pictures, as you'll see when you get to Baltimore, Eli Schlesberg in the Tomchei Shabbos. And the Tomchei Shabbos there is like an entire block. It's a tremendous a storage area. And they have the biggest kosher supermarket outside of the state of Israel on Seven Roads, I think it's called. It's famous. And that supermarket, after Pesach, all the Pesach products are given, anything left over goes to the Tomchei Shabbos, and it's distributed. You know, you're going to have something says kosher Pesach. It doesn't mean you can't eat it a few months after Pesach. All right. Now, Eli Schlesberg, as I mentioned, married a young lady named, 48 years ago, I believe it was. He married a young lady named Ronnie Schwartz. Ronnie Schwartz's mother is a Trenk. So her mother was actually a first cousin to Reb David. And Eli got to know him. And here he writes, and Eli's a writer, has published, "We set out for Lakewood a few months before Pesach 2019 to visit our dear cousin Rabbi David Trenk, who was not well at the time. To most of the world, Rabbi Trenk was the revered Rebbe at Adelphi Yeshiva and then beloved Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Moreshet Yoshua, Rebbe to thousands of Talmidim for more than 50 years. I took along my guitar, a memento of Camp Monk, where I first met Rabbi Trenk." Let me not take anything for granted. Barak, you know what Camp Monk is? Do you recognize the name Monk? Monk was a very important German Torah family. And with the Holocaust, some monks saved their lives, got to America, got to England, got to France, and the Monk family opened a camp that was famous. Torim Derech Eretz in the full sense of the word. Now, Eli Schlesberg, if you recognize the Schlesberg name, is also Charlie Hexter. You must be related. Yiddish Macha Tenenschaft, are you related? Yeah, Charlie is shaking his head, yes. All right, don't give me Ruach HaKodesh. It's just, you're a Yekin, he's a Yekin, and I'm a Litvak, and I'm related to everyone. Take my word for it. Yiddish Macha Tenenschaft, it's called. Ay, Barak, we got to send you to school to learn Yiddish. When I have a student this year, you have no idea who's sitting in front of me. This is the great-great-great-grandson of the Mashgiach of Slabodka, Reb David Zvi Heller, who was a legendary tzaddik. Reb David Zvi Heller was the father-in-law of Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, and another daughter was married to Reb Avraham Grzynski. You don't know who we're talking about. Now, I'm giving you this.
I actually know Reb Grzynski well, his son.
You're good, good. Now, I'm giving you this, and I want you to chart out for me how you're related, how you come down. You're from a daughter or from... There was one son.
From the one son.
From the one son. Very nice, very nice. No, it's not just that. It's you confirm my theory. My theory is very simple. How am I sitting here? How am I sitting here? I'm sitting here. Across the road in Chevron Yeshiva is Reb David Cohn, the Rosh Yeshiva. do you know that we're cousins? And he doesn't know it yet. I'm going to go in one day and tell him. We're Kalvariskis. You know who the founder of Torah in America is? Reb Dov Revel. It's our cousin. It's all Kalvariskis. It's an amazing family because it shows you there's something in our genes that we want to do nothing else but teach Torah. And you don't know what I've been offered in my life, including I should go to a 2 years to study with Warren Buffett. He offered me and Manja, a classmate of mine who's very famous. And we both turned him down. So most of our family is assimilated. What became of them after? But I have one thing. You see Balei Tshuva and kids that become Gedolei Yisrael. My theory is very simple. That our ancestors prayed before the Kisei HaKavod, Shelo Yidach Bimenu. Nidach has to remain. God promised us, the Jewish people, the Torah people, will continue despite all the vicissitudes. So you're sitting here, you have to thank Reb Dov Tzvi. He's praying that you should become a Gadol B'Torah. Okay? Amen. All right. Coming back here, so it's an amazing story. You got to know Yeki mentality to appreciate this. So Eli says that one summer I was at Ne'er Yisrael. I was planning to go to college during the summer. Suddenly, I'm told I'm at Ne'er Yisrael minding my business. Suddenly, Rabbi Neuberger approaches me and tells me that Rabbi and Mrs. Monk want to interview me about working in their camp. It was 69, not the year. It was the furthest thing from my mind, as I had already made plans to go to college that summer. Reluctantly, I went to a classroom in Ne'er Yisrael where the monks were interviewing. Here is a verbal account of the interview in its entirety. I entered the room, and Rebbetzin Martha Monk says, Schlossberg from Fluch? Yes, I said. My dad is from Fluch in Germany. She said, you will be the counselor for my three grandchildren, Pinny, Azriel, and Avrahami. End of interview. And he was hired. He goes to camp, and that's where he met Rabbi Trenk for the first time. And he describes the camp and the atmosphere. And then he marries Rani Schwartz, her mother at Trent. They become part of the family, and now they're going to visit him. And we're warmly greeted by Leah and Reb David. We sit around the dining room table. I pick up my guitar and begin strumming and singing the Nigunim of Rabbi Shlomo Kalbach. Together with other visitors, mostly Talmidim, we sang with Reb David for a good half hour songs like Lulei Toratcha, which defined Reb David's Torah life. And he sang, smiled, and clapped, and enjoyed. It was a beautiful kumsitz. Rabbi Kalbach said, quote, a nigun takes you from where you are to where you want to be. End quote. That visit took us to a very special place. 2 weeks later, on Erev Shabbat, I got a call from David. Eli, please sing me some Shlomo. Thinking fast, I said, Reb David, not only will I sing you some Shlomo, but even better, I'm going to sing to you on the phone together with Reb Shlomo. In a loud voice, I instructed my Alexa. It's a miracle I know what it's talking about. I only know because I saw it at Eli's house. Alexa! God, what a world. You people, your children, my great-grand, what a world. Alexa, play me the songs of Shlomo Kalbach. And so it was that in harmony with Shlomo, sang that Erev Shabbos to Reb David Trenk only a few weeks before he was Nifta. After our singing session, he sent me a note which I will cherish forever. Thank you so much, cousins, for all your chesed. You play the songs of Reb Shlomo Kalbach that are filled with Ahavas Yisrael, and this is what you personify. So now I ask you, Howie, a very simple question. Is Aaron Rakefet in good company with Reb David Trenk? And this already, we're dealing with the world of Lakewood, not the world of YU. But Reb Shleimela has been accepted, B'lev V'nefesh. And finally, I want to quote from a volume. I wish I had all my students in front of me. Yomo, I'm doing the best I can. A volume, let me show you in here, a volume by, again, I Xerox, I have the volume at home, Eli Schlesberg, who we're talking about. It's a tremendous volume, My Shtetl, Baltimore. That's where Eli grew up, that's where he lives, and he has a deep attachment, you know, where you grow up. Have a lot to say about this too, with Divrei Torah, but again, I apologize, Barak, it's not for now. I'm a Bronxite, and all my life I will remain a Bronxite. And that'll come out next in the next Sunday class before Yom Kippur, when I deal with the tshuva again of Arnold Edward. Now, taking his book in hand, My Shtetler, Baltimore, I'm going to page 125. Eli Schlesberg, who's a guitarist, and he has a very nice little review of how the Hasidic music came to America and was reborn. In his youth, he describes the Chazonim he heard. There was Ben Sion Schenker, legendary figure, David Vertigo, who's related to the Gerer Rebbe, Yessel Rosenblatt, I don't have to tell you, whose son was a Rav in Baltimore, actually. His grandson later is a Rav in Riverdale, my Talmud, from the Kollel, etc., Jonathan Rosenblatt. It's an Einigel. And then he tells the story. One very fun memory I have was the time when Dr. Gershon Kranzler, again, another legendary figure that I was privileged to know and teach his family, principal of Talmudical Academy of Baltimore, brought Rabbi Shlomo Kalbach to a school assembly. We were in absolute awe. Now you can imagine, this is a youngster, as he jumped up and down strumming his guitar. We were transfixed. For me, it opened a new world of music. That night, Schleimela conducted a kumsis at the Kranzler home on Devonshire Drive. It was an all-nighter. When my friend Eli Kranzler came to school the next day, he let me in on a special secret. When Shlomo got up the next morning, said Eli, he probably had gotten just 2 hours of sleep. He combed his very long beard, and you could see his neat, rounded beard was in fact long and pointy and tucked in neatly. All that just added to the musical aura of Rav Shlomo. He was our pipe man. I have to tell you, this combing of beards, I don't know, but I've seen Chabadnikim who are geniuses. And here I'll tell you a true story. B'didi Havi Uvda. Look into Washington. You'll see in the rabbinate that I was privileged. It built me, and I built the first Orthodox shul in suburban Essex County, 62 to 69. And neighbor at the tip of Newark in the Valesburg section was Shlomo, Rabbi Bo Gamilsky. And just want to get his first name right, but let it Reb Shmuel Bogomilsky. And he was the Rav there. And why did they hire him? There had been a Rav there before, was a RIU graduate, Rabbi Pelberg, was married, didn't at that point later marries, he winds up in Baltimore. It's bringing back memories. A. Pelberg was the name. Why did they hire Rabbi Bogomilsky and not a YU graduate? Because the Kehila, basically, how many Shomer Shabbos did you have? Well, a few and far between. But Rabbi Bogomilsky was not married, and his chabadnik, his price was cheaper. It was half the price of a YU rabbi. So they hired him. Rabbi Bogomilsky, it was a little bit hard for them to swallow because he wore, he had a beard, but not a long beard, not a long beard. And then he got married, Judith, Yehudit. I was at the wedding. And at the wedding, here is this rabbi with a beard down to his navel button. And we were flabbergasted. Then we found out they have a way of combing their beard up, of hiding it. And when they appear in public, they look semi-modern. But in reality, this is a Chabadnik who never touched his beard up. He Kabbalah, you all know what I'm talking about. And the Balabatim went bananas. What did we do? Who did we hire? And he's with a Bekesher and a beard. And did they start to make him tzarat. And he went to the Rebbe, it's a chassid, and the Rebbe, and he's telling the Rebbe, what should I do? And the Rebbe said to him, du so bleiben, du wetz bleiben, you'll remain, don't give in. Well, this had to happen, I would estimate the story I'm telling you is from 1962 or 63. If I'm not mistaken, it is now 2022. Correct or not? Yomo, what do you say? 2022, what does the Rebbe, this Rebbe always say? You don't open your mouth without thinking the results of your fnei. So, hu chacham haroet hanolad. And he is still the rabbi in the Shul Mount Sinai in the Velsberg area of Brooklyn. So Howie, if you're not a Chabad Hasid, you can become one. But what's important here, look at the impact Shlomo had in him. Till this day, and we're dealing here with Eli Schlesberg, this guy is of German origins. They don't play games. He's a Yekka. He's a from Jew. To this day, I am in awe of the musical wizard and capture of hearts. Shlomo made everyone feel special. One can say whatever they want about him, but the fact is he turned many, many Jews onto Yiddishkeit. It was he alone who restarted musical simcha after the Holocaust. Klal Yisrael had stopped singing, and now Shlomo was teaching our youth how to sing once again. He went through many stages, from Lakewood to 770 in Crown Heights, from Haight Ashbury, if I'm pronouncing it right, in San Francisco, to Israel during the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War, from Modi'in back to New York. But wherever Shlomo was, he brought friendship, chesed, unbelievable kindness, and tremendous simcha. His nigunim are overwhelming. The most commonly used nigunim for tefillah and simchat. He single-handedly revolutionized nigunim, nusach, and zmirat. His impact on the Jewish music made me dedicate the Kalbach Music Home in his memory. And I have to tell you, in the mansion that the Schlesbergs live in, there is one room, there's a big picture, Kalbach standing. The guitar, I think he has one of the guitars that Kalbach actually used. And in that room, Erev Shabbos, before you go to shul, you play his nigunim, you're transformed. And this was Shlomo. We have to give him credit. We have to bow our heads. A human being, yes. A mortal, yes. But something within him was a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam that he shared and inspired endless souls. And I'll end off. Yes, the bands play on, and Baruch Hashem, our music will always be unfinished. Beyond that, singing is not just for an occasional simcha. It is a spiritual and moving experience. Like the Torah one has learned, a person's inner song cannot be taken away from him or her. And Eli says, never forget this, I once heard a Holocaust survivor express it this way, quote, the Nazis took away everything from me, but they cannot stop the music in my heart, which gave me joy. And he ends off with, once again quoting, a niggun takes you from where you are to where you want to be. And this was Schleimela. Future generations will write about him, will be inspired by him, and I think our estimation of him is acceptable to the entire Torah world, from right to left. Let me go a step further. There was another Jew who grew up during the same period, a little bit younger than Schleimela Kalbach, a Jew who also wanted to change the world after the Holocaust. It hurts me when I read all the negative comments about Meir Kahana as if he was entirely negative and worthy of being disowned. There was a lot of positive in Meir. I'll evaluate. I don't say we have to follow everything he said or everything he did, but we have to understand the man, have to understand where he was coming from. And you'll see what I have to say about him. He had a big impact. The world doesn't even realize it. Way beyond Bnei Akiva and Aaron Rakefet, etc. Meir Kahana, his years 1932-1990. I want to see, in English, his name was, we spoke yesterday, he wasn't, his initial years, no one knew him as Meir Kahana. They knew him as Marty. His name was Martin David, Meir David Kahana. You had to know his father, you had to know his mother. When I talk about Meir, I'm talking about someone I knew basically intimately. It's already a difference. Schleimela knew, but I can't say I knew him that intimately. Esther Jungreich I knew very well, but not as intimately as Meir Kahana. Meir's father was a Rav, the roots of a family in Svat. His father, I believe, Czechoslovakian, Romanian, that area. Mastered English quite well. Had a big shteller in Brooklyn. Many of the shtellers in Brooklyn and the most prominent Orthodox rabbis, these were shuls without mechitzat. Separate seating. The balabatim is very important to comprehend this, because in the 2020s, this problem does not exist. In the 1950s, this was the rubric that you either crossed or didn't cross. It was the threshold. And the Balabatim didn't want a machitza, but they were orthodox and kind to the rabbi that they didn't insist upon mixed seating. And there were many shuls like that. Concourse Center of Israel, I'll give you an example from the Bronx, Rabbi Max Drub, Rabbi Morris Berman, the biggest shul in the Bronx, maybe the most famous, memoir literature, it always crops up again. And no mechitza, separate seating. Rabbi Berzin Shul in Brooklyn was similar at the time. Rabbi Charles Kahana, Meir's father. You can go right down the line. What's fascinating today is that because, in my humble opinion, the Rav's stand on mechitza, even where they innovate and they're left wing and it's Shira Chadashar and it's Avi Weiss and everything that goes with it, and Chovevei Torah, But no one will take down the mechitza. It's very fascinating. But this was Meir's father. Meir's mother, if I'm not mistaken, she was American born, and a typical from American mother of that era. Meir's parents had two children. Meir was the older one. As you see, he was born in 32. he had a younger brother, Nachman Kahana, who was my age. I believe he was born in 37. It can be checked out on the computer, but we were in the same Shabin in Bnei Akiva. And Nachman went on to become a tremendous Talmud Chacham, came in Aliyah around the time Malka and I did. I don't remember if before or slightly after. Lives in the Old City, the Young Israel of the Old City, a whole series of Svarim on Tosfat. That is Meir's kid brother, the salt of the earth. Meir's father would say about his two sons, I have two sons. One is Meimaribah and one is Meimenuchat. And that's a very apt description of the two boys. Now, let's be very accurate. What year was he born? Did you get it? When?
The brother?
Yeah. It doesn't show up. All right, I'm pretty sure I'm right. If I'm off by a year. But we're in the same shape. And Meir was raised in a home. His father was a political right winger when it came to Israel. His father was a tremendous supporter of Jabotinsky, Trumpeldor. These were legendary names in Meir's youth. In 1937. Yeah, we're in the same Shevet, so I figured we're the same year. In 1937, if you look at Washington, I have exact details there. But when Meir was 5 years old, his family had a tremendous tragedy. His cousins from Tzfat went to a wedding in Tel Aviv. On the way back, they were ambushed, and five members of the family were killed. So you don't have to be a great psychological genius to understand the impact that this had and a five-year-old Meir Kahana, all right? And you can check the details. It's either four or five members of his family ambushed in a taxi and killed. And, you know, we have this all the time. If you recall the Sabaro tragedy, there was an entire Dutch family wiped out. A boy and a girl were left. They lost an older, they lost a sibling. They lost their parents. How can you come out of it and not be anti? Meir's first arrest was when he was a kid, and Bevin, the English foreign minister, arrived in New York, and he was with a whole group of Beitar youngsters throwing tomatoes at the party of the English foreign minister. Was still before the State of Israel. The white paper was still in effect. You couldn't go in Aliyah. You can't blame him for throwing tomatoes at Bevin. That was his first arrest. Education-wise, Meir was being raised in a very open, modern, Orthodox environment. He went to Flatbush Yeshiva, and he was in the very first graduating class of Brooklyn Talmudical Academy. Now, before Barak goes into orbit trying to understand what I'm talking about, what is TA doing in Brooklyn? If you would organize a branch of YU in Flatbush today, it would be closed down instantly. Demonstrations, tomatoes being thrown. Apikarsim, all right, some of the people in Flatbush will say quietly, I'm a Talmud of Rav Rakefet. Oh, he's a good man. He's the exception that proves the rule. You understand? But we got to be honest. Flatbush is Flatbush. Borough Park spilled over. I have a lot of Talmidim in Borough Park, too. I have a lot of Talmidim in Satman Square, in Ger, you name it. Chabad is understandable, Lakewood, etc. But there are reasons why. But, you know, the why you image, I don't have to tell you, if you saw the post on Friday, I'm still shaking. Why do you blame why you if a girl goes into a room with a boy? You understand? You can't be raped if you're not in a room together, unless the modern world has innovated the concepts that I don't understand. But then blame why you, everyone jumps in the Jerusalem Post. The scandal broke in Wednesday's commentator. It was already the second lead story on the front page Friday morning. Remember, we're 7 hours ahead of New York. So, man alive, they got it and said, what idiots. Who's the girl? What's the girl? Anonymous. What was she doing in a room with a boy? When I taught in Machon Gold, boys were not allowed above the first floor. First floor, there was a lounge, there were tables, there were chairs, there were people walking back and forth. All right, boys and girls, halavai should speak to each other. Many good shidduchim came out of it. Shidduchim that lasted, not foolishness. But what do you want against YU right away? YU's fault. I protest, let it be recorded. And remember, when it comes to sexual issues, I'm not a make-you. I'm not lax about it. But, Ribbono Shel Olam, don't blame why you. We have men and women in the world, and you have menuvalim. I spoke in America yesterday. I got various stories. Until I can investigate, I don't want to say anything. Okay. Now, what happened? What happened was as follows. Talmudical Academy was organized by my cousin, Rabbi Dr. Dov Revel, the man who turned the spade in America. It was planned, and in 1915 he took over the presidency of Yeshiva Shabbos Kolchanan, and the high school actually opened. Everyone says 1915. It actually opened its doors January 1916. Okay. MTA throve and thrives until today. By the 40s, a lot of Jews were living in Brooklyn and didn't want to travel uptown and didn't want to send their kids to Torah V'das. Torah V'das was starting to move right. And they weren't comfortable with it. There was already talk against college and university. So they pressured YU. Dr. Revel, then it was Dr. Belkin. Dr. Belkin already had vision. He took over in 44, 43 to be exact, but really the innovations begin in 44. And he understood the need to have a branch in Brooklyn. In 1945, that branch was opened, and it was very successful for many decades. There's a who's who of the graduates of BTA who conquered the world. Meir Kahane was in the very first class. Afterwards, you can give a whole who's who, Rabbanim and famous lawyers and people who came in Aliyah and built Israel. Unfortunately, the most famous graduate of BTA, I'm not so proud of, it's Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz was a year or two where I graduated MTA in 55. I think he graduated BTA in 56 or 57. Meir Kahane was in the first class. And Meir Kahane goes on to Mir Yeshiva. Mir, it's, as I mentioned, very close to Brooklyn College. He was learning in Mir, the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Avram Kalmanovich, Rabbi Shmuel Birnbaum. They were very, very fond of him. Meir was active in Beitar. From Beitar, he comes to Bnei Akiva. He rises in Bnei Akiva. He becomes the head of a Ken in the Bronx, Ken Mizracha. And I owe my life, my eternity to Ken Mizracha. That's where Meir was my madrich. When Meir was sitting shiva for his father, it has to be, I may be wrong, but BTA boys, BMT boys went Lenachem Avol, and it has to be his father. And he was sitting shiva in Kiryat Arba, and people were Menachem Avol, and Meir says to them, where are you studying? They say, well, we're at BMT, Beit Midrash LaTorah. The mayor says, do you have Rav Rakefet? They say, that's a favorite Rebbe. He says, ask him who made him into a Zionist. And the boys came back to me and said, I have to be Moida Lamed. Mayor made me into a Zionist. Mayor married, I still remember the engagement party, Libby Bloom, a lovely girl, also part of our crowd. Libby may have been my age, slightly young, I don't remember. All I know is that at her engagement, she was not yet 18. But by her wedding, thank God, she was 18, because otherwise you need a judge's permission to marry that young, at least in America at that time, in Israel today, by the way. They upped the age of consent, I think. I may be wrong. It could be that the Haredim can still get away with 17, but I don't think so. I think you have to be 18, and if it's 17, you need a judge's permission. And I still remember the marriage and Meir. And Meir was a very, it was really, you know, a moment in time for us, Meir Kahana. Meir Kahana. And a lot of what I'm mentioning now, I'll give you exact quotes. I just want to give you an overlook at his life now. And Meir kind of very charismatic, a tremendous speaker. And he has smicha now. He has 3 different degrees. He has a bachelor's and he has a law degree. And he has a degree in political science. Very, very capable. And then something happens. And here I have to tell you from the bottom of my heart that this incident, you have no idea how it influenced my life. You'll understand in a second. It gave me the strength to overcome difficulty. And I nimodel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What happened was, Meir went into the rabbinate. We're talking like 1959. Went into the rabbinate. What was the story? He became rabbi of Howard Beach Jewish Center. A new shul, just organized, a new area, big buildings being built, and they're looking to build a shul. They didn't want too many from people, but they wanted a shul, a rabbi. And Meir, you know, speaker, charismatic. Shul did not have a mechitza, but they had separate seating. And Meir accepted it. And this like hit us, you know, Meir's friends, Meir's chanichim, if I can use a B'nai Akiva word, is, okay. We were all his followers. What would be the word in English, chanichim? What word would you use in a camp? You're a counselor. And what would you say, the kids in your bunk, what are they called? Kids who you're responsible for. Chanichim in English. Nu yomo, you know English better than I do. All right, no one's giving me an answer. Campers, that's not good enough. We were not campers, we were his students, but you're not students, you're chanichim. What?
Charges.
Charges, no. In Hebrew, it's talmidim, chanichim. There's, okay, whatever. So we were all excited. Meir's in the rabbinate, a new shoe, and this. And Meir starts in the rabbinate, and who is he successful with? The kids. And kids are going home and they're asking their parents to make the home kosher. Now, I don't have to tell you how much has been written on this, Balei Tshuva. I know one family. Let me just tell you. I know one family. I believe there are 4 children. And this is a third generation or a fourth generation American Reform Jews from Germany. All 4 kids became frum. And their parents' home remains treif until today. The mother, as last I heard, was still alive. I don't know, an elderly lady. It's too hard for her to make the home kosher. And she loves her children, loves her grandchildren. Some of the children live in Israel and very successful. And how the children became frum is an unbelievable story. Let me pause. I've told it years ago. Let me tell it again. There are new faces in front of me. One of the kids graduated college, a wealthy family, well-to-do. So his father said, you're entitled to a trip to Europe. So the kid goes to Europe, Spain and Portugal, and he says, hey, you know what? For the same money, let me visit Israel. Hey, kid comes to Israel, he goes to the cult, doesn't know where the heck he is. At the cult, they tap him on the shoulder. Would you like to hear a few lectures? We'll give you room and board for 2 weeks. And all you have to do is, every morning, there are two lectures, and in the afternoon, you do what you want. Kid said, why not? P.S., he never came home. They sent the other kid, bring your brother out of there. What happened to him? Kid never came. They're my students. The kid never came home. Sent the third kid. He never came home. They said to the daughter, you're a woman. You have seichel. You have sense. Sent the woman. She never came home. They all married. B'nai Torah, Bala Tshuva, whatever. What a story. What a story. One part of the family is here. I have a Haredim, you know, in Neve Yaakov, etc. Ugh, what a story. So he had an impact on the kids. And some of the kids started pressuring their parents. No, people got upset. Imagine you're asking your parents to come back to their roots, to their blood. Parents got upset. Then Thursday night, I have all the dates. Everything is documented in Washington, and I've spoken about this. Very important. New York Times picked up on what I said. Either someone told them, or we both shnei neviim mitnabdim b'signon echad. And Thursday night, he took a group of kids into the shul, and they put up a machitza. No one's there. Put up a machitza. The Balabatan come Shabbos, they went crazy. They called the meeting on Monday night. Check Washington. Washington, Sunday they got together, informed everyone. Monday night they fired the rabbi. Mayor took it very hard. This is what the world doesn't understand. When you go through something like this, Meir to begin with was always a headstrong individual. He was bright. He was handsome. He studied. You're aware of that. When people stutter, what does that show you? The Rav stuttered. Geniuses stutter because their mind runs quicker than their mouth. The Rav, when he spoke in public, Meir, when he spoke in public, they didn't stutter. It was an amazing thing. But in private, and by the way, that's why the Rav always held the manuscript in front of him. One of the reasons, because he stuttered. When he held the manuscript, he was much more sure of himself. So, Meir, hear the Balabatam slap your face and tell you to go? Who don't want to fill it in? He never could be a team player afterwards. This incident, along with what happened when he was 5 years old, left an indelible impression upon his character, upon his psyche. And you all know I've said this 1,000 times, and I knew him intimately, and I guarantee you I am correct, even though I'm trying to predict history. When he came in Aliyah, Menachem Begin and Gula Cohn offered him a safe spot on the Gachal ticket to run. That was the precursor to the Likud. You follow me, Barak? And he turned him down. Not good enough, not honest enough, not principled enough. And I often say, had he only not turned him down, he could have gone on to become prime minister. Look at Bennett. Look at Naftali Bennett. Look at his personality. Meir was as strong as Naftali, and vision like Naftali, and frumkeit like Naftali. I give Naftali Bennett all the credit that happened in Washington. It's playing big all over the world. It's doing more to enhance Torah Hashem than 1,000 sermons by 1,000 good Orthodox rabbis. But Meir, he turned them down. All right. I turned down a similar offer, but I had my reason. I told Chaim Druckmann, Chaim kani lo yichol lazov et hakita. HaKadosh Baruch Hu bara oti lak lelamed Torah lechadesh ulelamed. Atayach ani omeid betzel chosha. I sit in Yeshua, I stand in Yeshua. I mean, I didn't want to put him down. But I knew where I belong. But Meir didn't have that excuse. Wow. But that story with Howard Beach, it ricochets. Now, how did it affect my life? This is in parentheses. Nothing to do with Meir, but it shows you how the people you know, your friends, the interaction. I'm not that much younger than Meir. I graduated YU 61, I got smicha. In my days, I was part of the last of those who got smicha at 23, because I'd studied with the Rav 4 years in his class. You went into the rabbinate. There was no kollel. I'm from the last of that generation where either you know how to learn or you'll never know how to learn. Finished. Here I am, 23 years old. And while you didn't have auxiliary classes like we have today, even a class like this, a class like yesterday, prepares you for the big world to a certain degree. I wasn't prepared. I go into the rabbinate that first year, I was slaughtered. I could have crashed. I could have lifted my hands and said, forget it. Forget the rabbinate, forget serving the Jewish people. Let me get it. I wasn't a stupid kid. Maybe medical school like my brother. I mean, whatever I wanted to do. I was 23. That was a hard year. I don't even go into more details. Now read Washington. I was reelected by 9-7 by the Board of Trustees. Professor Charlie Lieberman, Zichrono Levracha, became world famous. I told you 1,000 times on the article he wrote in Judaism, where I'm the case study, I'm the appendix, the young rabbi put in Aaron Rothkopf, and he analyzes why 9 people voted for me and 9 people voted against me, and his analysis is fabulous. But that was a Pyrrhic victory. You don't stay in a shoe where it's 9-7. It's like they come to visit the rabbi in the hospital. Rabbi, we got good news and bad news. What's the good news? The board of directors voted you a refuah shleimah. What's the bad news? The vote carried by 1. Okay. And I would say to myself, I can't let what happened to Meir happen to me. I can't let this destroy me. And I have to be honest. I don't know whether I would have had that attitude if not for Meir's heartache. I remember like yesterday talking with my wife and talking with my brother, and we're all listening, what's with Meir and what's happening. And then it was very sad. Meir, the 60s are sort of blocked out. You don't get a complete picture of what Meir did. First of all, we do know, and I write about this, He became a newspaper delivery boy. What you don't realize is that even today, newspapers are delivered. Today already it's less because everyone gets their news online. Even yours truly, I don't jump every hour to hear the news. I know, I'll turn on the computer, I'll get the news. It's a different world today. But people wanted the news. I don't have to tell you, it's part of the American psyche. Your coffee, your breakfast, and you're reading the newspaper. How many comics, how many jokes where the wife is trying to tell the husband something and he's involved with the Wall Street Journal and with the New York Times, Lahabdil Beinehem, and the mayor, you don't know how much money you make because you have a whole distribution and each door you jump out of your car, you drive a jalopy, you throw the newspaper, and you make a good living. And Libby told me Meir would be home by 9 o'clock in the morning. He was finished. He made his salary. He could learn. He could do whatever he wanted. He could write. And Meir wrote, you got to give credit, for the Jewish press. Jewish Press engaged him. He wrote his first article was The End of the Miracle in Howard Beach. That was his first article. And then from till the day he was assassinated, Meir was a regular columnist in the Jewish Press. It provided him with panasa. Now, there are other rumors. Again, a definitive story has to be told that he worked for the CIA, that he worked for the FBI, that he was called upon to infiltrate right-wing movements. There may be truth to this. Again, I don't know. The volumes that were written on Meir, some of them were written by his detractors, and they go out of their way to paint an evil portrait of him. I don't know whether they can be accepted as being scholarly correct. His wife, Libby, Should Live and Be Well, wrote two massive volumes. There's one more that should be due out. Libby wrote two massive volumes. Yomo, I just got turned off. I'm back on.
Recording in progress.
Can you hear me? We were just turned off. Wave to me if you can hear me. Jack, wave. Can you hear me?
No.
Now, can you hear me?
No.
No. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, good. We're talui b'dei acherim. It's a system that's not yet perfect, to say the least. And there were all types of stories. What's true, what's not true, I don't know. I can tell you, and this is a fact, that Meir taught at Central Yeshiva High School for boys. What am I talking about? Do I have the right name? Central Yeshiva High School in Kew Gardens Hills. I believe that's the correct name. Howie, would you know? Would anyone know? Central Yeshiva High School for boys. I believe that's the correct name. Maybe it can be checked. It was in Queens. It was in Kew Gardens Hills. And I had many students in BMT who had studied with Meir in high school. And he was a very inspirational teacher. He got them excited. He got them committed. They went to demonstrations. Meir was Meir. Let me go one step further. Perhaps Meir's greatest achievement, it may be second only to JDL, and we'll talk about JDL, or maybe more important than JDL, and this no one debates. Meir was the first one to raise the issue of Soviet Jewry. This is before Birnbaum, before Triple SJ, before Shlomo Lekal Bacham Yisrael Chai, before the massive movement. He was the first. And he was arrested time after time after time. And I had students in BMT who were arrested with him. And they said what was amazing, when they were in the paddy wagon taking them to the police station, all Meir would do was speak the Dvrei Torah. All right, they were arrested, they were released. You got to remember, there was a lot of anti-communist feeling. So you might come to the police station and there's a sergeant sitting at the desk, and under his breath that this Italian guy, this Irish guy, is saying, God bless these Jewish boys. I wish I could spit in the face of the communists. But this was Meir. You throw eggs, you throw tomatoes, you run after Soviet diplomat cars. It's not a program that can bring tangible success. It created knowledge. It created understanding. There's no doubt in anyone's mind that Triple SJ and all that happened afterwards could not begin in a desert. There had to be a basis. And Meir Kahane deserves all the credit. He was the first one. More than that, and this is something I only found out from my work in communist Russia, and I'll give you details, but just to put it in the context of his life, in America, people accepted it but didn't agree with his method. The impact in the refusenik community was fabulous. He gave them, if I can use a Yiddish word, stolzkeit, pride. Pride. I think that's the best translation from stolzkeit. But it doesn't, to me, it doesn't convey. Stolzkeit conveys much more. Gave them pride. And for this, you got a compliment, Mayor. No one was talking about Russian Jewry. He was the first one. And this already began with Mayer in the 1950s. In what I'm writing now, I actually finished all this. I'm writing something else, but right now I'm proofreading the first part that was published. It's a major piece. I consider it, I've said more than once, laugh at me now when you study it and read it when it's published, see if I'm right or wrong. I consider it the most important piece I've written because it combines all that I'm interested in life, Torah, Hashkafa, the Jewish people, the state of Israel. And I recreate when the Russian issue first began, and I tell a story that I later am able to add a footnote from a book that just came out now by Rabbi Aaron Adler, and I'm the happiest person in the world that my memory is 100% correct. And it all began, I'll tell you, and details you'll get when this is published. After the death of Stalin, under Khrushchev, there was a serious attempt and a semi-successful attempt to enhance relations between America and Russia. And as part of this, the Russians were permitted to have an exhibition in America on Russian life, and the Americans were permitted to have an exhibition in Russia on life in America. Believe it or not, you can find movies of this online. I believe, Yomo, you helped me when I was working on this a few years ago to get the exact day. It's unbelievable. I can't go into more details, it would take hours, but how the Russians used propaganda in America, and they accused the Americans of using propaganda in Russia, showing that every American lives in a private house. You know, Russians shared little apartments, families. But it's amazing. Now, when this happened, suddenly you went to the Colosseum, I think it was 56, middle of the 50s, New York, big display. Everything in Russia, a wonderland. And suddenly people started asking, what about the Jews? Why can't they have shuls? Why can't they have yeshiva? Why can't they go in Aliyah? People started asking. And this is where Meir Kahana already began yelling, shouting, demonstrating. Now, what's the fallout of this? Fallout is very simple. 57, I entered the Rav Shir. I'm sitting, the first year I sat in the second row. 1 year later, the seats all went with Chazaka, the seats near the Rav. 1 year later, I inherited Rabbi Lewittis, young Rabbi Lewittis, Joel Lewittis, the son of Mendel Lewittis, young, he's 84 today. But then we were youngsters. I inherited his seat. And I was right on top of the Rav. Yitz Rubin, Rabbi Rubin, was in the second row, a seat behind me and a seat or two to the side of me. In the picture in Rakafara and Chelik Dala, which I'm very proud of, I identified everyone's in that famous picture. And by the way, Barak, do you have room for any more books in your house?
Yes.
Are you willing to accept books, or your wife will say we have too many?
We're in the market for books.
You're in the market. So please accompany to my office. I will honor you with two volumes, Chelek Gimel and Chelek Dalet. And you'll see the picture. So one time, I remember like yesterday, a kid came over to the Rav after Shia. The Rav would sit in his chair, and I would be sitting high. We wouldn't leave. The kids closest to the Rav, we wouldn't leave till the Rav got up to leave. Sometimes we carried a book for him, whatever. And walked him across the street, even to his mother's apartment. I'm reliving it, Amsterdam. I see it in front of my eyes, Amsterdam Avenue. Kid comes over, Rebbe, you know that demonstrations are being organized for Russian Jewry. Should we participate? And the Rebbe looks him right in the eye and says, I quote word by word, what? We should make the same mistake we made during the Holocaust? Absolutely participate. And that's what I heard from the Rav. It's 57, 58. Absolutely. That becomes crucially important because later on the Lubavitcher Rebbe is very opposed to demonstrations. Rabbi Teitz is opposed to demonstrations. The Haredi world to a certain degree opposed to demonstrations. And this explains to you why the Rav was no longer an agudist. He was a Mizrachist, and read what I have written, and Be'ezrat Hashem, I hope it's La'amita Shel Torah, and Rabbi Aaron Adler quotes exactly the same thing, word by word, from the Rav, 25 years later, every syllable he said in the 50s. And by the way, it's discussed in a tshuva, I cited in depth, by Rav Herzl Henkin, Hashem Yikom, Zeich Tzadik Levracha, Hashem Yikom, the more of his two children, Lo Aleinu, ach, the price we pay. My dear students, Meir Kahana deserves all the credit, even those who don't agree with him, but if you're honest intellectually, and Jacob Birnbaum was and others, they said it all began with Meir. They perfected it. They turned it into a vehicle that became usable, tangible, admirable, and I'd also say a vehicle that could attract someone who didn't want to throw stones and rocks and tomatoes, etc. But he deserves the credit. Now I want to end off the class, and I have to be intellectually honest. If I don't touch upon this, I will be arrested and accused of being a follower of Art Scroll history volumes. In the mid-60s, a scandal broke. It's no secret, the books that are written against him. Estelle Donna Evans, a stage name. Her real name was Gloria Jean D'Argenio. You know what I'm talking about? This lady, I'm happy to see you don't know. Front page of the Daily News, other New York papers. This lady, who was not Jewish, became a follower of Meir Kahana. She was very capable. She was a young girl, 21 years old, and she committed suicide. If I recall correctly, she jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge, but check it out. It can be checked out. It's well known she committed suicide. Later, Meir established a charity fund in her memory, which the bulk of the money was from her parents. She came from a well-to-do home. All right, I need not tell you, Meir was accused, there are many different versions, I don't want to go into it, but essentially he was accused of having an affair, she was converting, he promised to divorce his wife. Don't ask what has been written, what has been said. Is there truth to it? I have to be honest, I don't know. I don't know. Those who attacked Meir, those who wrote books against him, and I have those books, they swear that it is absolutely true. I have students who were supporters of Meir and worked with him, and some of them tell me, Rebbe, you're naive. It's true. They quote a Maimon Chazal to me that I have to admit, I don't have much trouble understanding my Marei Chazal. This one Barak I have trouble with. Kol hadagdol mechavero yitzro gadol mechavero. Are you familiar with that Maimon Chazal? All right, I don't want to translate it. But there is, if Chazal said it, there has to be truth to it. But I have to tell you, I always was troubled. I remember telling this to students, how can you tell me that Meir is guilty if they establish a fund in her memory and the bulk of the money is from her parents? I never got a proper answer. The topic has never been researched thoroughly. I have to also tell you, Libby remains with Meir, the children remain with Meir. Very difficult to accept this as fact. On the other hand, there's no doubt about it that this issue hangs fire in the sense a woman did commit suicide, the papers picked it up, it became very scandalous, just like they jumped on YU and Jerusalem Post, the rape in YU, they jumped on this issue, Kimotze Shalo Rav. One other issue, Meis Inyan Linyan Balto Inyan, one other issue that clouds Meir's history, his life, these demonstrations ultimately grow out of hand. And all of you know that they attack Sal Hurak, his office. He was a Jewish man who ran a business with entertainers, bringing entertainers, promoters to the stage, to Hollywood, to New York, and he brought the Russian Bolshoi. Don't have to tell you that this was an attraction, what the Bolshoi, and Russia did have achievements, whether Yomo wishes to admit it or not. Anyone who has seen the metro in Moscow, you just stand there, you're overwhelmed when you think of the New York subway and the British underground. The Russia did have achievements. The Bolshoi is one of them until today. And they bombed the Sal Hurak's office, and you all know a Jewish secretary, a young lady, was killed. And this, of course, we'll talk about it next time we meet. This leads us to the whole question of law and order and Torah and Mishpat and a Jewish state and a state that has Jews in it but is not a Jewish state. How do we react? How do we do? And these two issues, Donna Evans and Sal Hurak, whenever people want to criticize Meir, they have on what to criticize. The Hurak story is true, 100%. The Donna Evans story hangs fire. No one has ever researched it impartially, what really happened here. Can we research it? Can we recreate it? Open to question. But I know from other scandals that I've seen and have never published about, you can go back. I went back to 1935, and I'm able to recreate exactly what happened in Yeshiva College, etc., even though it's many decades later. Could be, but someone has to undertake it. So I mention the issue, but I take no sides whatsoever. It hangs fire. My dear students, to reiterate, first of all, Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu, to be honored by so many people looking at me on screen, some of you staying up all night to hear the shir in New York, elsewhere. Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu that I had the energy to give a major shir yesterday in Shas Poskim, etc. And today, to be handymaid of Torah. I wouldn't say learning Torah history is as important as learning Torah, but it enhances our commitment, our understanding. What did we do today? We finished out Shlomo LeKalbach, And I showed you that Aaron Rekefit, in his appreciation of Schlemmel Kalbach, is not off. Reb David Trenk has exactly my same point of view, and that makes me exceedingly, exceedingly happy. We come to Meir Kahana. We're dealing with an explosive topic. With Schlemmel, there was only one problem, the problem of his relationship with women and men on a semi-sexual level. You come to Meir Kahana, you're dealing already with a lot more layers of difficulty. But never forget the positive. To paint Meir totally black, that's not Meir. Tremendous achievement. There were side issues which we can agree or disagree with. I agree with some, disagree with others, as we will see. But a fascinating life story. And when you understand what happened in 37, the tragedy of his family from Tzfat, and when you understand Howard Beach, you start to get a much greater insight into Meir's personality. All right, are there any questions on this end of the ocean? I want to thank you and remind you that next Sunday, Monday, there are no classes, Erev, and Erev Rosh Hashanah. On the week afterwards, Erev Yom Kippur, normal classes. I hope that on that Sunday we'll have very good news about Yomo. And if Eli Weinstein is listening, he owes us a bottle of the finest scotch imaginable, like you brought on my birthday, and we'll drink a l'chaim, b'lei v'nefesh, to Yomo. And then we pick up again the Sunday after Shmini Atzeret. Back to normal for many weeks then, and I hope to impart knowledge to the second power. And it leaves you with the challenge, Barak, to turn it into the third and fourth power on your own. Be'ezrat Hashem. Open, I want to, until we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danya. Open it up to the world now. Open, can you speak? Anyone have questions? Can they hear me? What's going on? Jack, signal me if you can hear me, wave. Yes?
We can definitely unmute.
I don't know. What do you do?
Anyone could speak now.
Anyone could speak. Anyone have any questions?
Where have you sent an email?
What, wait, I can't hear where?
You just sent an email.
Where do you
sent an email.
About, you sent an email about Bennett, about the Shabbos.
That, just now, yeah.
Yeah, that article was in
I just sent another one.
Well, if I'm teaching...
I sent another one now.
Okay, if I'm teaching, I'm not looking at emails, so give me a chance.
No, that's fine.
Give me a chance
to get back
to normalcy. Okay, I want to thank you very much for your participation. I don't know if the lack of questions means I've been so successful of convincing you that I'm speaking the truth and telling the truth, or is the lack of questions, the Rebbe is daydreaming, it won't help to bring him back down to earth. Rabbi Grinstein, we spoke about your new volume yesterday in detail, so I trust, I don't think you were on screen, so I trust you'll hear the Shayur and pick up the give and take on your volume. What do I see there? Stephen Felsenthal, Milburn Ridgefield. Is Milburn a first name?
Somebody put that there for work.
Aha, okay. Havanti, because...
the company I work for.
Milburn, I know, but that's a place in New Jersey that was right near where I rabbinated. My dear students, thank you for honoring me with your participation. I want to wish everyone a ktiva v'chatima tova l'shnat chayim shalom osha v'osha rak v'sorot tovot, and above all, anyone above 70, briyut, with a capital bet. Those below, it's important, but generally speaking, you're healthy. When you hit 70 already, one leg starts to shake. When you hit 80 already, the gvurat, I need not tell you what Mori Rebbe had to say about it to Herzog, the ambassador to Canada, who was asked by Dulles, what does it mean that you need special strength to hit 80? But I can tell you, unfortunately, I understand it very well at this stage in life. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das vidanya. Shana tova. Thank you.
Shana tova lekulam.
Thank you.